Welcome back to Mark's Madness, now part of Chunkaluta.
Hello.
Hello, we're doing it again.
We're always here, like Sisyphus, but for reading.
The great boulder of the next page. Anyway, welcome back to Mark's Madness, part of Chunkaluta Network. We read books. We're going to be continuing back on the Gramsci reader that Prez here has prepared for us. We will be on slide 203 when we resume.
And news regarding the reader. I added a chapter, so I'm sorry, everyone.
We were assigned more homework.
But at the very end, it's not going to mess up our reading order or anything. I just tacked on something at the end.
Okay, so
because post-colonial theory pissed me off the other week, so
I press his personal axe grinding homework. You're welcome. anyway, but with that, we do usually start with current events, and again, you know, there's a whole lot going on in the world, and there's not enough attention being paid to the displaced people across Congo and Sudan, and obviously, you know, the constant conditions we always bring up, you know, reservations on this show. I think they're relaunching attempts to try to put the TMT on Mount Achaia. So, you know, a lot of shit going on that needs to be fought. But the thing that's kind of in the prism of the eye, because it's the genocide that has the world's attention, and it keeps being a little more blatant just for no good reason other than they can. And that is what is happening in Gaza with Israel's genocide of Palestinians. And of course, Israel's expanded bombing campaigns. I think we first probably should bring up the aid workers, and then we can talk about the embassy. So there were seven aid workers from, and it was, what was it again? It was World Central Kitchen. This was the group that kind of took over when UNRWA was run out by, you know, supposedly they had like 12 Hamas members out of the 2000 and had to have all of their funding destroyed or whatever the propaganda crap was. So then World Central Kitchen comes in, and they're the ones, you know, trying to distribute aid. And there is like documented record that they contacted the IDF and were like, hey, you know, we're right here. Don't shoot us. And then they're like an actual car that the missiles struck multiple times. It was highly targeted. The actual vehicle has like World Central Kitchen and the logo and everything just right on the top, which is not for people to read, like driving by or taking photos of it or something like that. That is for you to see overhead and not fucking bomb them. And they got hit, and that cost seven lives. That is, of course, a war crime. That should sow absolute disgust because, you know, not only these aid workers, but the part of that is to worsen the famine, to make people afraid to bring in aid, to let people know if they bring in aid, they will be killed. Right. So it's a massive crime. But conversely, in spite of the meaning of the same deaths and how the impact it can have on growing deaths of Palestinians, it also seems to be getting a massive amount of attention. And I think there was a really good Middle East Eye article that was written the other day by Peter Aborn that like, hey, you know, if we're worried about this because it's going to kill more Palestinians over and above the seven deaths, and because it's a war crime, why aren't we, like, we seem to be giving this a lot more attention than the other war crime and the actual 30,000 dead Palestinians.
Well, because one of the aid workers was an American, and also with international norms. So first of all, there's just the fact that Palestinians are brown and no one gives a shit about that. Mm-hmm. But with the norms of it all, that even for the warmongers in the New York Times, you don't go after the journalists or the aid workers because that's their people.
Yeah.
that's them.
Yeah, well, and even this too. Like, there's been a record number of journalists killed.
Yeah,
and it seems like that's gotten a little less hand wringing. And I remember even Khashoggi got like a bunch of attention, but I think even among journalists, and that's what I'm trying to say, even among journalists, there's their guys and not their guys, you know, and they don't really care about journalists being killed if they're journalists for, you know, that other side.
Well, because the buffer is starting to fall. Finally, we know that the Israel has been able to get away with killing a lot of people and killing a lot of journalists, but they were always like Al Jazeera journalists. They were never New York Times journalists.
Yeah.
But even today, coincidentally, like a day or two after Hillary Clinton said that it's between Biden and Trump and get over it if you're unhappy about it.
Yeah.
The New York Times said is essentially put in a analysis or op-ed or something questioning whether or not Biden is actually going to act on his quote unquote outrage.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, well, because it's so odd. Here's the thing is, I think you're right about talking about a buffer. Okay. There's a level of horrors that the average, like, everyday liberal and even more than that, let's be real, because most people have a lower threshold than this. It's the pundit liberals. And most people have a lower threshold, or, you know, seem to have the same thresholds because they're not getting the information because of the pundit liberals. But there's a certain threshold of horrors that the pundit liberals are fine because it's out of sight, out of mind. And they like that it's out of sight, out of mind. And they'll apologize for it as long as it's their president doing it, right? And then there's a level of horror where, you know, they're always for disappearing homeless people, disappearing drug addiction, disappearing poverty, disappearing, you know, the people that stand in the way of U.S. empire and may be negatively impacted, and shoving that all away. But there's a level of horror where they can't disappear it, or the process of disappearing it has to be so violent because it's such a high rate that even that process all of a sudden is too much from being in their sight, and they've got to at least back that down. And I think a genocide at this level it's getting past the pundits' like taste for U.S. empire. Not all of them, mind you.
If there's one thing we should take away too, for remember from all of this Gramsci reading, it's that the journalists are part of the state, but they're also part of the whole ideological structure and the superstructure and the wider common sense. And as much as we want to criticize them for being state actors, they still operate within the confines of liberal ideology, which is, you know, as bullshit as it is, at a certain extent, it is international liberal rules-based order. And yeah, we can say that, you know, well, there's exemptions for brown people and it's really built on colonialism and all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, these liberals still fundamentally believe in some way that the colonizers, and Israelis are colonizers, these people, the good people, need to abide by some kind of rule, lest they fall into the trap of being the people they're supposed to be civilizing. So after a certain extent, it becomes too much. And then they start to say, like, maybe we're going a little too overboard. Because we saw that too in you know, past colonial endeavors with the U.S. and Vietnam, but also with Britain and France and Germany and all of these things. There was always resistance, even among the liberals, for essentially like, I'm okay with colonialism, but we're going back around the back end.
Yeah. We also,
we're civilizing the wrong way.
We also, you know, ideological taxonomy is a lot less arbitrary than other types of taxonomy, but some of these dividing lines are a little arbitrary between people, and there's always a gradient too. So we're talking about these groups because we should. That's how the world operates. And you have to understand the broad ideologies and the groups that are there. We should be talking about class. We should be talking about Marxists versus, you know, liberals versus reactionaries. But to understand like this process of the falling off, it's because there's tons of gradients within there, and that gradient has always been there. And all of a sudden, like the too bad, or the, oh, I'm suddenly aware of the bad and coming across it, or something like that, you know, that starts to happen as worse and worse things happen. And those gradients of people that maybe wouldn't be comfortable if they were, you know, that aware of it because it was always in their face, start to be more uncomfortable with those, you know, those ideologies and those processes. And the unfortunate thing is they fit in that bubble because you can usually pack them back in if you tone that down. But they're you know, jumping up with the tone that down. And sometimes there is real change there. And a lot of that, you know, the ruling class fears quite a bit, but their hopes, and unfortunately very often it works that way, is that they cause enough destruction and have enough ideological pull that when they do tone it back down, even the people they've lost, you know, they've killed off enough resistance, or they've, you know, they've been able to like rewrap things and send it back around like the way liberals did, you know, after the George Floyd protests, right?
The George Floyd protests are a whole other level, but that will get us on a whole different tangent.
Yeah. So speaking of the liberal rules-based order and not hurting the people that they're not supposed to, there was an Iranian embassy in Syria hit by Israel.
The Israelis bombed an embassy, which is too much even for the U.S. Because we all in the Marxist side really like to talk about the U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy during the Yugoslav wars, which the U.S. did on purpose. But the U.S. recognized how much of a diplomatic fuck up that was and proceeded to do a whole bunch of shit. And still to this day, despite all of the tensions, is still paying the families, is still saying we didn't do that on purpose, it was by accident, still doing all of this stuff. Because you don't hit an embassy. Mm-hmm. Israel, though, was like, yeah, we hit it. What are you going to do? And now it seems that one of two things or both things are happening. The U.S. has warned Israel that Iran is going to attack or have retribution against Israel in the next like 48 hours. So the conspiratorial side of me thinks that the U.S. is going to put its competent CIA hat on and do something and use Iran.
There has been a lot of murmurs of of the get Netanyahu out, like he's the problem of Israel. So that would unfortunately that would add up a lot.
That would add up, but also I wouldn't put it past Iran to do something as well, because they also use that embassy strike to take out some top level general. Like they hit the embassy on purpose because they knew that there were some high level generals there. This is kind of the equivalent of when the U.S. took out Soleimani.
Yeah, which I was pretty shocked that didn't like spark World War III then and there.
I wasn't, because quite like, this sounds like American arrogance, but like, do you really want to get into a world war?
Okay. Yeah.
Like, as shitty as that was, it's what it, I wouldn't necessarily, if I was, if we're doing the John Mearsheimer kind of thing.
Yeah.
Of realism, I wouldn't necessarily want to spark a war with a major geopolitical rival.
Oh, I get that. I get that. But like,
they start doing more like cyber hacking and more back end stuff after that. So the proxy fights really picked up after that. But I would, in this case, I would be much more confident taking on Israel than the U.S.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
But yeah, so Israel did like one of the mortal sins of diplomatic international relations.
And they're still getting weapons from the U.S.
And they're still getting weapons from the U.S., so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but Biden's real mad. He's shaking his fists and all the weapons and dollars falling out in Israel's hands, but he's shaking them real hard.
To be fair, we don't know if the fist shaking is from old age or he's actually angry.
So with that, I guess it's time to get back into Gramsci. So we are still on the modern print section. We are now on slide 203, and we'll be picking up at these methodological criteria acquire their full significance only if applied to the examination of concrete historical events. This could be usefully done for the events unfolded in France from 1789 to 1870. I think that for greater clarity in the exposition, it is really necessary to take in the whole of this period. Indeed, only in 1870 to 71, with the Communard attempt, were all the germs born in 1879 historically worked out. In other words, not only did the new class struggle for power conquer the representatives of the old society who did not wish to admit that they had been decisively overcome, but it also conquered the newest groups, which held that the new structure, which has arisen out of the development begun in 1789, was already outdated and thus showed that it was alive in comparison with both the old and the very new. Further, with the 1870 to 71, all the principles of political strategy and tactics born in practice in 1789 had developed ideologically around 1848, lost their efficacy. Those which are summed up in the formula of the permanent revolution, it would be interesting to study how far this formula passed into Mazzini's strategy, for example, the Milan insurrection of 1853, and whether this took place consciously or otherwise. An element showing the correctness of this point of view is the fact that historians are in no way in agreement, and it is impossible that they should be, in the fixing the limits for that group of the events which constitutes the French Revolution. For some reason, Salvemini, the revolution, example Salvemini, I should say, for some example Salvemini, the revolution was completed in Valmy, France. Oh, France had created a new state and had been able to organize the politico-military force to assert and defend its territorial sovereignty. For others, the revolution continued until the Thermidor. And moreover, they speak of more revolutions. August 10th is, according to them, a revolution in itself, etc. The method of interpreting Thermidor and the work of Napoleon provides the sharpest contradictions. Is it revolution or counter-revolution? For others, the history of the revolution continues down to 1830, 1848, 1870, and even until the Great War of 1914. In all of these views, there is some truth. Really, the internal contradictions of French social structure, which develop after 1789, are relatively composed only in the Third Republic, and France has 60 years of balanced political life after 80 of ever longer waves of revolution. 1789, 1794, 1799, 1804, 1815, 1830, 1848, and 1870. It is precisely the study of these waves of varying frequency which allows us to reconstruct the relations between the structure and superstructure on one hand, and on the other, between the development of organic movement and incidental movement in the structure. It can at the same time be said that the dialectical interaction between the two methodological principles put forward at the beginning of this note can be found in the political historical formula of permanent revolution. An aspect of the same problem is the so-called question of the relations of forces. One often reads in historical narratives and expressions like favorable relations of forces, unfavorable to this or that tendency. Thus, abstractly, this formulation explains nothing or almost nothing. since all it does is repeat the fact, which ought to be explained. Presenting it once as a fact and once as an abstract law, as an explanation. The theoretical error consists, therefore, in giving a canon of research and interpretation as a historical cause. At the same time, it is necessary to distinguish different stages and levels in the relations of forces, which fundamentally are the following. A relation of social forces, closely tied to the structure, objective, independent of men's will, which can be measured by the precision of the exact or physical scenes. On the basis of the level of development of the material forces of production, we have social classes, each one of which represents a function and has a given position in production itself. This relation is what is stubborn reality. No one can change the number of factories and their workers, the number of cities with the given urban population, etc. This fundamental scheme enables us to study whether there exists in society the necessary and sufficient conditions for its transformation. Enables us, that is, to check the level of reality and attainability of the different ideologies which have come into existence on the same basis, on the basis of the contradictions which it has generated in the course of its development. Gramsci going hard with that historical materialism in the most cliche place to do it, France. A later stage is the relation of political forces, that is to say, an estimation of the degree of homogeneity, of self-consciousness and organization reached by the various social groups. This stage can be, in its turn, analyzed and differentiated into different levels, into various levels. My goodness, I can't read. Corresponding to the different degrees of collective self-consciousness, as they have manifested themselves up to now in history. The first and most elementary is the economical cooperative stage. One trader feels that he must be solid with another trader, one manufacturer with another. In other words, a homogeneous unity is felt, and the duty to organize it by the professional group, but not yet the wider social group. A second stage is that in which consciousness of the solidarity of interest among all the members of the social group is reached, but still in purely economic field. Already this stage, the question of the state is posed, but only on the basis of reaching a political, legal equality with the ruling group, since the right is proclaimed to share in legislation and administration and even modify it, reform it, but inside the fundamental existing framework. A third stage is that in which consciousness is reached that one's own corporative interests in their present and future development transcend the corporative circle of the purely economic group, and can and must become the interests of other subordinate groups. This is the more strictly political phase, which marks the clear transition from the structure of the sphere of complex superstructures. It is the phase in which ideologies were germinated earlier, become party, come into opposition, and enter the struggle until the point is reached where one of them, or at least one combination of them, tends to predominate, to impose itself, to propagate itself through the whole social sphere, causing, in addition to singleness of economic and political purpose, an intellectual and moral unity as well, placing all questions around which the struggle rages not on a corporative but a universal plane, and creating this way the hegemony of a fundamental social group over a number of subordinate groups. The state is conceived, certainly, as an organism belonging to the group, destined to create the conditions favorable for the greatest expansion of that group. But this development and expansion are conceived and presented as the motive force of a universal expansion, of a development of all the national energies. That is to say, the ruling group is coordinated concretely with the general interests of the subordinate groups, and the state life is conceived as a continual formation and overcoming of unstable equilibriums, unstable within the ambit of law, between the interests of the fundamental group and of those subordinate groups. Equilibriums in which the interests of the ruling group predominate, but only up to a certain point, i.e., not as far as their mean economical corporative interest would like. In historical reality, these stages are reciprocally mixed, horizontally and vertically, so to speak. According to the economic and social activities, which is the horizontal, and according to the territory, which is vertically. Combining and splitting up differently, each one of these combinations may be represented by its own organized economic and political expression. It is also necessary to take into account the fact that international relations are interlaced with these internal reformations of a nation state, creating new, original, and historically concrete combinations. An ideology coming into existence in a more developed country is diffused in less developed countries, cutting across the local play of combinations. That's a pretty interesting take that would go a long way towards explaining, you know, decolonization being much more effective in Marxism than anything Western, both because of the inherent revolutionary nationalism you could see that was talked about in the third stage, but also because of the diffusing of the ideology as well.
It's almost like this is the guy who wrote the Southern Question.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Okay. This relationship between international and national forces is again complicated by the existence inside each state of several territorial sections with a different structure and a different relation of forces at all levels. Thus, Lavandier was allied with reactionary international forces and represented them inside the bosom of French territorial unity. Similarly, Lyons in the French Revolution represented a particular knot of relations, etc. The third stage is that of the relations of military forces, time and again immediately decisive. Historical development oscillates continuously between the first and third stage with the mediation of the second. But this is also not something indistinct and immediately identifiable in a schematic form. Two levels can be distinguished: the military level in the strict or technico-military sense, and the level which can be pilot political military. In the development of history, two levels are represented in a great variety of combinations. A typical example can serve as a demonstration limit, is that of the relationship of military oppression of a state over a nation which is seeking to achieve its state independence. The relationship is not purely military, but politico-military, and in fact, such a type of oppression would be inexplicable without the state of a social disintegration among the oppressed people and the passivity of the majority. Because of this, independence cannot be achieved with purely military forces, but with military and politico-military forces. This is the war of position over war of maneuver stuff manifesting in revolutionary action, it seems. I do want to go back to where he talks about the third stage being the only place where the party exists, because something that's interesting reading through this and when Graham should talk about oscillating between the first and third stage and channeling through the second, right, is that throughout all these stages, like, there's always different populations that are like, if you drilled it down to an individual, and yes, individualism is stupid, so we shouldn't drill it down to an individual. I'm just expressing something here. If you drill it down to an individual, the gradients, you know, there's first stage and third stage and second stage ideologies in the stage all the time. What we're describing is like the mass consciousness of the ideologies and which stage they're in, right? And I guess that makes sense of why you couldn't have the party, because even if like the real, I think when people think of like, you have to form the party, you have to do the party this time, this, like the real ideological party and group of people that do the work and that exist and that can become the vanguard can exist while it's there in the third, in the first stage. But until the third stage, until there's a way to raise the consciousness and have it, you know, followed by a large group and have yourself any power, you're not really a vanguard party. You're just a group, you know, doing revolutionary work, hoping to bring that revolution about. And we see that as a party, but a party's really got to like lead a class of people.
Well, because also remember what he means by party, and the whole point of this essay is him laying out what the party is. For him, the party is not just what we think of the party as, you know, PSL or, you know, Communist Party of whatever the fuck country. For him, the party is the controlling group of the state. So when he says the third and final stage is the only stage when the party can exist, he means that because at the final stage, the party, that's the only time the party can actually control the state. Before that, you, for him, you do have a party. He was part of a party. But for him, that's different. There's the party and then there's the party.
Yeah.
So when he's talking about the third stage or the last stage where you can finally have the party, he means that the party can come to its full potential. And the party will be able to run the media, run the economy, do what it actually needs to do, rather than just coordinate people into a revolutionary moment or through a revolutionary moment. Because those are two very different tasks. And as we've seen through the last 100, 150 years, and well before that, as he keeps mentioning history. Yeah,
he's explicitly tapping out like detail on France and detail on France. He really goes, he goes back here a lot. As he keeps saying,
we've seen parties and they've come and gone, specifically because they weren't able to actually capture the state. So you can have a party and then you can have a party.
Yeah. And I think that's it, because he put a lot of marker years as different waves. And most people would put like three big revolutions for France, right? You have French Revolution, European Spring, and I can't remember the Western for 1870, but the one where the Paris Commune occurred, where Germany was getting a little too close to home. But he broke it up into like each major phase of change, right? Like you had the fall of Napoleon, you had 1830, you had all of that stuff in there as like a different wave. And then he just said two different degrees and characterized them as the same thing. And that fits this kind of like rolling, like stages and rolling party, right? And France was just like slapping that third stage every few years. The oppressed nation will therefore oppose the hegemonic military force initially with a force which is only politico-military, that is, with a form of political action which has the virtue of causing repercussions of a military character in the sense. One that is effective in breaking up from the inside the war efficiency of hegemonic nation. Two, that obliges the hegemonic military force to dissolve and disperse itself over a large territory, nullifying the greater part of its war efficiency. So basically, like, it's a political action that has military consequences if you were defeating the ruling class's forces. In the Italian Risorgimento, the disastrous absence of political military leadership can be noted, especially in the party of action through congenital incapacity, but also in the Piedmontese moderate party, both before and after 1848. Certainly not through incapacity, but through economic political Malthusianism, or in other words, because it was unwilling even to mention the possibility of agrarian reform and because it did not want the calling of a constituent nation assembly, but only aimed at extending the Piedmontese monarchy without limitations or conditions of popular origin to the whole of Italy solely with the sanction of regional plebiscites. Dig the fuck in there, Gramsci. Jesus. Another question. Or do you want to start reading now? I've read like this whole time.
Sure.
It's all one big section, so we have to pick an arbitrary stopping point.
Another question connected with the preceding ones is that of seeing whether fundamental historical crises are directly caused by economic crises. The answer is contained implicitly in the preceding paragraphs, where we dealt with questions which are only another way of looking at the present one. Nevertheless, it is always necessary for didactic reasons, given the particular public, to examine every way of presenting the same question as if it were an independent and new problem. It can be excluded that by themselves, economic crises directly produce fundamental events. They can only create a more favorable ground for the propagation of certain ways of thinking, of posing and solving questions which involve the whole future development of state life, For the rest, all assertions regarding periods of crisis or prosperity can give rise to one-sided judgments. Malthus, in his review of the history of the French Revolution, opposing the popular traditional history, which quote-unquote found a priori a crisis coinciding with the great breach in the social equilibrium, asserts that around 1789, the economic situation was, on the contrary, good in the short run, and that therefore one cannot say that the catastrophe of the absolute state was due to a crisis of impoverishment. It needs to be observed that the state was in the grip of a deadly financial crisis, and the question arose of which of the three privileged social orders ought to bear the sacrifices and burdens in order to put the state and royal finances in order. Further, if the bourgeoisie was in a flourishing economic position, the popular classes of the cities and countryside were certainly not in a good situation, especially those who were racked by endemic poverty.
Can I, in any case, real quick? Both because a lot of people know about it more than most revolutions, and because, you know, I didn't want to get bogged down with it. I mean, we've even covered it before on Marx Manus way back in the early aughts. I didn't want to get in any more details than Gramsci was giving on French revolutions. But just so people can make sense of what was said there about the classes and the fall of the Ancien regime with the financial crisis had a lot to do with squabbles about taxing land. That had basically, like, there were certain privileges, all kinds of gradient privileges, about like taxing and not getting taxed certain ways from different counties or, you know, former kingdoms and things like that. And a lot of those tax questions is really what sparked like the whole fucking thing and the distrust and the finances and the monarchy, so that people can make sense of it being like a fight between three privileged classes of who wanted to pay more than, you know, just a pure financial clusterfuck.
Where was I? You messed up my place.
In any case, the breach of equilibrium.
In any case, the breach in the equilibrium of forces did not come about through the immediate mechanical cause of the impoverishment of the social group, which had an interest in breaking the equilibrium, and in fact did break it. It came about within the framework of conflicts above the immediate economic world, connected with the prestige of classes, parentheses, future economic interests, and parentheses, with an exasperation of the feeling of independence, autonomy, and power. The particular question of economic malaise or health as a cause of new historical realities is a partial aspect of the question of the relations of forces on their various levels. Changes can be produced either because a situation of well-being is threatened by the selfish egotism of an opposed group, or because malaise has become intolerable and one-sided, and intolerable, and one cannot see in the old society any force which is capable of mitigating it and reestablishing normality by legal means. One can therefore say that all these elements are the concrete manifestations of the incidental fluctuations of the totality of this of social relations of force, on the basis of which occurs the transition of the latter to political relations of force, culminating in the decisive military relationship. If this process of development from one stage to the other is lacking, and it is essentially a process which has for its actors men and the will and capacity of men, the situation remains static. Contradictory conclusions can arise. The old society resists and is helped by a quote-unquote breathing space, physically exterminating the opposing elite and terrorizing the masses of reserves, or the reciprocal destruction of the conflicting forces takes place with the establishment of the peace of the graveyard. What a dark term. But under the watch of a foreign guard. the most important observation can be made about every concrete analysis of relations of forces is this, that such analyses cannot and must not be ends in themselves. Parentheses, unless one is writing a chapter of past history, end parentheses. And they only acquire significance if they serve to justify practical activity and initiative of will. They show what are the points of least resistance where the force of will can be applied most fruitfully. They suggest immediate tactical operations. They indicate how a campaign of political agitation can best be presented, what language will be best understood by the multitudes, etc. The decisive element in every situation is the force, permanently organized and pre-ordered over a long period, which can be advanced when one judges that the situation is favorable, and it is favorable only to the extent to which such a force exists and is full of fighting ardor. Therefore, the essential task is that of paying systematic and patient attention to forming and developing this force, rendering it ever more homogeneous, compact, conscious of itself. One sees this in military history and in the care with which at all times armies have been predisposed to begin a war at any moment. The great states have been great precisely because they were at all times prepared to enter effectively into favorable international situations. And the situations were favorable because there was the concrete possibility of effectively entering them. A little bit of a chicken and egg description there.
Yeah, but I mean, you do have to have you have to have military buy-in to order something on high, or you're going to get cooed, and you have to have public buy-in to push things. I mean, this is just the war of position versus war of maneuver, really hammered out super well. I do also like that it's talking about, you know, using those purely you've been railed against or Gramsci's railed against economism, but using these, you know, that you can only look back in retrospect permanent causes as how do we find the rally cries of the country, right? You know, if there's a bunch of people sitting there like, why don't we have healthcare? You know, taking money just a little bit out of the military and putting it towards healthcare should not be your goal, but you should be pointing out, well, fuck, you know, 2% of the military budget could stop bombing some children halfway across the world and, you know, give you free healthcare. let go of your student loans, right? We shouldn't be gunning for that reformism or centering our politics around that. But those are gains we would want, and those are ways we can make people understand the corruption, understand the problem with the current system. We have to grow up past that. You know, we have to integrate decolonialism and land back and Marxism-Leninism in a total revolution. That should go without saying, but I want to clarify.
Yeah, and if this is still a little vague, keep in mind he's still writing from prison. So there's that limitation. But also I think this... Again, I mentioned before, there's some overlap with Mao. I think this fits pretty well, or this goes pretty well with Mao, especially whenever Mao writes, this is how you get peasants on your side. This is what you do so you know when it's time to strike. Gramsci kind of did a cop-out at the end. He's like, well, you'll know when you'll know because the time is right. But Mao goes into a lot of detail about how to figure out when the time is right, and then also goes into self-criticism essays about this is when we thought the time was right, but we actually fucked it up and lost a lot of men. So if you want that more practical aspect of this, go read Mao's stuff, essentially going through this exact exercise.
I think that would be good. And I think it's also good when you read those to circle back and understand that not only are they incredibly insightful and there's tons of universal applications in there, and they're certainly any better, you know, work than we have out of our current situation. Also keep in mind too that Gramsci was imprisoned and fighting fascism, and Mao was bogged down
also in fighting fascism.
Also fighting fascism, bogged down in an extended civil war that carried through World War II and beyond, you know. And I think sometimes reading Mao, people should not lose sight of that. Not only to, you know, better understand day-to-day application and you know, what draws distrust and how easy or hard that's going to be in our current situation. But also to give yourself hope that you can do this, you can organize, because things seem impossible. Well, when you're bogged down in a civil war, while you have to fight alongside these fascists you're fighting against to stop, you know, fascist Japan from colonizing you and causing God knows how many, you know, brutal incidents, like, and revolution can still happen. Right. So, yeah, you know, we kind of live in the panopticon where, you know, the belly of the beast is very well guarded, but shit ain't hopeless. And there's a lot of strategy and knowledge here. And it always comes down to get buy-in, get, you know, make sure you're a revolution for what people need, and start with the most oppressed people and get all classes that this revolution applies to and benefits involved. I think we can probably do the one other section. We'll probably have to stop it on bureaucracy. Did you want to get it, or do you want me to?
Well, I think that we'll have to end partway through this section.
Okay. Okay. Then we can just nix it. Okay. So that's been Mark's Madness Pod.
Never mind. I could read this. For some reason, when I heard you say on bureaucracy, I was like, wait, hold on. That's not this section. And then I didn't scroll down to see that on bureaucracy is only like 2 pages away.
Oh, yeah.
So okay. Cut that whole part.
Okay.
Next section, observations on some aspects of the structure of political parties in periods of organic crisis. At a certain point in their historical life, social groups detach themselves from their traditional parties, i.e. the political parties in that given organizational form, with the particular men who constitute, represent, and lead them, are no longer recognized as the proper expression of their class or fraction of a class. When these crises occur, the immediate situation becomes delicate and dangerous, since the field is open to solutions of force, to the activity of obscure powers represented by quote-unquote men of destiny or quote-unquote divine men. How are these situations of opposition between represented and representatives formed? Situations which, from the field of the parties, parentheses, party organizations in the strict sense of the parliamentary electoral field, newspaper organization, end parentheses, are reflected throughout the whole state organism, strengthening the relative position of power of the bureaucracy, civil and military, of high finance, of the church, and in general of all the organisms which are relatively independent of the fluctuations of public opinion. And I just want to note that the use of the word organism is not a translator error. He is saying organism on purpose to mean that these are close to parallel with a living being, with somewhat of their own mind and own free will. In every country, the process is different, although the content is the same. And the content is a crisis of hegemony of the ruling class, which comes about either because the ruling class has failed in some big political undertaking for which it asked, or imposed by force. The consent of the broad masses, like war, or because vast masses, especially of peasants and petty bourgeois intellectuals, have passed suddenly from political passivity to certain activity and put forward aims which their disorganic, complex, that's a weird phrase, which in their disorganic complex constitute a revolution. One speaks of a crisis of authority, And this is, and this in fact is the crisis of hegemony, or a crisis of the state in all spheres. And this crisis is the basis of how fascism can develop.
Yeah. And you could see that it's also the crisis is also the opening for revolution as well, right? We've talked about revolution and counter-revolution coming in, especially in losing wars. But now we're getting a broad explanation of why losing wars would foment revolution, with a broad category that losing war fits into. So you don't just have to limit it to that, right? You know, the ruling class comes out and they failed in a big political undertaking. And when you say a war, so you understand the level of political undertaking we're talking here, right? And it fails. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to continue on that, like, and when you think of a lost war, you know, remember, like, the civil rights movement and the war in Vietnam happened at the same time. So, yeah, losing a war is an opportunity for revolutionary change. But, you know, even when you don't get the full, complete revolution.
And with the civil rights movement, it's important too that there were people who went over and were okay with the civil rights movement because they were saying, you know, essentially, why are we spending so much money bombing when people are dying and being fucked over here? But a big part of the civil rights movement was civil rights activists being anti-imperialist and saying, why are we being a colonial power?
Why not? A lot of them would not only say, like, why are we doing this in the first place? And a lot of civil rights activists were very against the war. You know, obviously MLK should come immediately to mind there. But also there was a lot of speak of, like, why do I want to fight for the people that oppress me? You know? And that rose a lot of political consciousness. So again, there's a mechanism where you can see these kind of crises that break the consent of the masses are an opening for revolution or counter-revolution. You know, you saw 9/11 and like, you know, why aren't we securing ourselves or whatever? And the mass expansion of the state.
Yeah. So 9/11 was actually the example I was going to use before, because the Vietnam War is much more complex. After 9/11, we essentially went into the Iraq War and with the Patriot Act and all of that bullshit. And the government essentially said, give us all of these powers. We will solve terrorism.
And everyone, sure, why not? And if you don't clap for troops extra, extra hard, I don't think. Oh my God. I think a lot of people younger than me, even who are alive for 9/11, if you weren't, I would say anyone who probably is under 30, maybe under 28, something in that range, might not be old enough to remember, like, just how dire of a flip to jingo, because like there was plenty of jingoism and support for the troops and stuff before, and it was a whole different character.
I just mostly remember getting out of school that day.
There was like,
because I was in like kindergarten.
I mean, the military commercials that they took try to recruit people, which were much more desperate for a much smaller military, right, had to have you like fighting lava beasts to make the military seem cool. And then after that, it was just defend your country, fight terrorism, you're in, be a hero. And it took nothing. You know, there was like maybe one major charity that would, you know, talk about veterans. And then you'd maybe think of, well, the VFW takes care of that. And now it's like, if you're a quote unquote charity, the most charitable thing you can do is honor veterans. So a bunch, like every fucking company has, like, you know, we may be destroying the environment, and maybe in this modern consciousness, we think we probably have a charity for clean water in Africa or something, but most of us just have a charity that like folds flags and claps for them real hard.
See, like, I grew up with that, so I literally don't know any other way. I had no idea that shit started in like 2001.
Yeah, like there was always some, but like something like the Honor Flight now, You would never see Honor Flight shit, like level shit, before 2001. The planes flying overhead at football games, that was not a thing. Right. Oh, I think it was 2008 even when players finally started standing outside of the national anthem. You should just be in the fucking locker room. No one would care. You'd go to a baseball game and they'd be singing the national anthem. And unless you had, you know, knew someone that was in like a middle school band in the national anthem, you wouldn't fucking care if you're at a hot dog stand. You'd only stand up if you're in your seat. Now people like it, there's places in the stadium, they're still normal like that, you know, when people go into the back, but there's places where, you know, you get closer to the well-paid seats and everybody like stops and like the fucking walkway for it. It was a whole different character. Like the jingoism just exploded after that.
Hey, but yeah, so they essentially said, let us, and you know, there's all the economic shit that happened in the background, but the political promise was essentially, let us, privatize everything and funnel all of the money to war and remove all the social services and we will secure the country. And not only did that fail in terms of military objectives, we also brought the war home. And now we have hyper-militarized police, but we also have military doing shit within borders, and we have militarized border patrol. So now we have this big political undertaking essentially backfiring. And now people are becoming more and more discontented with it. We might not be at the point of revolution that he talks about, but, you know, I would say that this whole crisis of authority thing is we're at that point right now.
No, that
just based on all of that.
That makes sense. It's also it also going back to like the France and the waves and things like that. You know, we're thinking about the big wave of like the civil rights movement, and then the flip back of 2001, and then almost now the flip back is people tire of all these, you know, losing wars too. So
the crises create immediately dangerous situations because the different strata of the population do not possess the same capacity for rapid reorientation or for reorganizing themselves with the same rhythm. The traditional ruling classes, which has a numerous trained personnel, changes men and programs and reabsorbs the control which was escaping it with a greater speed than occurs in the subordinate classes. It makes sacrifices, exposes itself to an uncertain future by making demagogical promises, but it maintains power, strengthens it for the moment, and makes use of it in order to crush its opponent and disperse its leading personnel, which cannot be very numerous or well-trained. So, see, every 4 to 8 years when we have a new fucking president.
Yeah, no kidding. It's interesting too that the point you're talking about being in this crisis and all of these being opportunities for revolution, counter-revolution, and Gramsci going into here, that like no matter which way this winds up, when it first happens, the ruling class actually re-entrenches their power and they go out to crush movements with it, and you can see that with, like, you know, some of the fear mongering and the panic around it, and the way, you know, they've like launched, like, you know, some of these like any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism type campaigns, and the way the right wing's taken advantage of that with legit anti-Semitism and things like that, right? And the important message here is that this is the time to steer what the outcome of this stuff is, not you know, take solace in or be afraid of how it's began, because it always tends to begin the same way, just, you know, based on your material conditions.
Well, it's also not only that, it's the fact that when they are experiencing a crisis, one of the first things they do is throw their current leading figures under the bus.
Yes.
So think about
Oh man, elections are perfect for that system too.
Yeah. So like, think about how like we'll have a one term president, or we'll have there's a big political issue that happens, and then we'll just see someone get fired.
Yep.
To satiate the public or some other shit like that. So the first
one cop will get prosecuted for shooting someone.
Exactly. The first thing they do is that they're willing to put someone at the stake.
Yeah.
To show that they're willing to do some minor changes. And also to have a minimal change of tack.
You could even go back. Because
that minimal change of tack, they hope, will head off any actual leadership. Because this, remember when Biden did actually try to have a minimal, like a very minor student loan repayment relief? That actually worked.
Yeah.
the debt repayment movement in the U.S. died.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes that, that's why liberals keep doing this, right? They have they're always seen as the one that ends these problems, because they're the ones that will like speak up for something, and then they'll say, like, you know, just in this municipality for 2 years, we'll reduce this by X percent, or like some kind of, you know, and again, how temporal it is, how narrow it is, that's going to vary by the size of it. And I guess people would consider that Overton window, even though I think it's a pretty imperfect concept. But they'll do that, and then they'll just gain this reputation, because those little things, those little messagings will get the people that are more left wing that still buy in to like, you know, oh, this is my place, I can vote. And then because of the average liberal populace, no matter how reactionary they actually are, contains people who are, you know, genuinely at least more left wing than the ruling class. They're thought of as left wing party, even as their policies and most of their rhetoric is generally the same as Republicans, and certainly the ideology they put forth.
The transference of the effectives of many parties under the banner of a single party, which better represents and embodies the needs of the entire class, is an organic and normal phenomenon, even if its rhythm is very rapid and almost like a thunderbolt in comparison with calm times. It represents the fusion of a whole social group under a single leadership, which is alone considered capable of solving an existing predominant problem and removing a mortal danger. When the crisis does not find this organic solution, but the solution of a divine leader, it means that there exists a static equilibrium whose factors may be unequal, but in which the immaturity of the progressive forces is decisive. That no group, either conservative or progressive, has the force for victory, and that even the conservative forces needs a master. See 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. This is referencing his theory of Caesarism and Bonapartism.
Yeah,
that we'll touch upon later.
Okay. I do want to point out too, because it kind of came to my mind while reading this, we're talking about, you know, the ruling class throwing people under the bus, and Graham, she's talking about the different rhythms of classes, right? But, you know, there's all kinds of different strata of people. And when I'm talking about these larger groups ideologically, like liberals losing their taste for, you know, things going too far, and that a lot of that is, you know, the difference of strata of people within these ideological groups, as we broadly categorize them, almost moving to these other rhythms of shifting their morality around on the fly, you know?
This order of phenomena is connected with one of the most important questions relating to the political party. That is, to the capacity of the party for reacting against the spirit of habit, against the tendency to become mummified and anachronistic. Parties come into existence and are constituted organizationally in order to lead the situation in historically vital moments for their classes, but they are not always able to adapt themselves to new tasks and new periods. They are not always able to develop according to the development of the complex relations of force, and hence relative position of their classes, in particular the country or in the international field. In analyzing this party development, it is necessary to distinguish the social group, the mass of the party, the bureaucracy and high command of the party. The bureaucracy is the most dangerously habitual and conservative force. And here he's directly referencing the Soviets. If it ends up by constituting a solid body, standing by itself and feeling independent from the masses, the party ends up by becoming anachronistic. In moments of acute crisis, becomes emptied of all its social content, like an empty shell. And this was still in the early days of the USSR. One can see what happened to a number of German parties with the expansion of Hitlerism. The French parties are a rich field for this research. They are all mummified and anachronistic. Historical political documents of different phases of past French history, whose outworn terminology they repeat, the crisis might become even more catastrophic than that of the German parties. Those who examine this kind of event usually forget to give a correct place to the bureaucratic, civil, and military elements. In addition, do not keep in mind the fact that such an analysis must not only include active military and bureaucratic elements, but also the social strata from which, in the given state complex, the bureaucracy is traditionally recruited. A political movement can be of a military character, even if the army as such does not openly participate in it. A government can be of a military character, even if the army as such... Did I read that right? A political movement can be of a military character, even if the army as such does not openly participate in it. A government can be of a military character, even if the army as such does not openly participate in it. In certain situations, it can happen that it is convenient not to quote-unquote reveal the army, not to make it step outside constitutionalism, not to bring politics among the soldiers, as it is said, in order to maintain homogeneity between officers and soldiers on a basis of apparent neutrality and superiority over factions. It is still the army, i.e. the general staff and the officers, which determines the new situation and dominates it. On the other hand, it is not true that the army, according to the constitutions, must never be political. The army must in fact defend the constitution, i.e. the legal form of the state, together with its connected institutions. Therefore, the so-called neutrality means only support for the reactionary side. But it is necessary in these situations to pose the question in this way in order to prevent the army reproducing the descent of the country, which would lead to the disappearance of the determining power of the high command through the disintegration of the military instrument. All these observations are certainly not absolute. At different historical moments and in different countries, they have very different import.
And we will pick up next time with On Bureaucracy. This has been kind of a long episode, as is. So I will just let you know, obviously, fundraising efforts continue to get people housing on Pine Ridge, anything from trailers to teepees. Obviously, you know, year round, in the winter, there's GoFundMes for wood, for keeping people warm. All of that can be found at the Linktree, linktr.ee/chunkaluta network. That includes social media links, where you can find us on Twitter, @MarkMadnessPod or @chunkaluta.org, or @decolonialmarks for Shigmanitu. On Gmail, chunkaluta network@gmail.com and marksmadnesspod@gmail.com. You can get to the Marks Madness Pod Discord. That is, the link is on the Twitter bio. That is public. And of course, there is a Patreon, which would help us, you know, be able to pay content creators a fair wage, help Shigmanitu survive. And of course, is, you know, any funds can also be put towards efforts by the Chunkalooked Network in totality. And then if you subscribe to the Patreon, there's also a Chunkalooked Discord you can be in. With that said, do you have anything else, Prez?
I do not.
Okay. This has been Mark's Madness Pod, part of Chunkalooked Network. We read books. My name's David.
I'm Prez.
And we will talk to you next week. Bye.